Hey everybody, and welcome to the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Dockeel, and today my guest is Ben Dowsett. He's the deputy editor and senior writer on Basketball Insiders. We're going to talk about just a whole bunch of random things in the NBA. So, you ready to tip it off? Ben, how you doing?
Good, Mo. Thanks for having me. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. I'm happy to have you on. I've been excited to get you on. I've been wanting to for a while, so I'm glad we could finally make it work today.
And yeah, absolutely.
We're recording on a Tuesday. It's going to come out Wednesday, but everybody's talking about it, which means we got to do it too. The Cavs come back against the Knicks last night. I don't know how much of the game you may have saw, but you know, what did you think of it? Like, you know, the Cavs have been struggling defensively. They're getting their ass kicked in the first half. We had a little dust up between LeBron and Nyakila, whose name I can't say correctly, and Cantor, but then they got going in the fourth quarter. Kyle Korver gets red hot, hits 21 points in the fourth. You know, what did you have a chance to see it? What were your thoughts?
Yeah. So I was kind of watching like intermittently because I was at Vivint Arena for a home Jazz game that was taking place at the same time. But I got my League Pass broadband going, and League Pass broadband is better this year, as I was writing about recently. So I was I was watching it. I think I caught like most of it. I think like a lot of people, I turned it off in the third quarter at one point because the Jazz game was on right in front of my face, and the Cavs were down, you know, whatever, 20 or 25 or whatever they were down at some point in that third quarter. And I was like, well, I don't need to watch any more of this. And then at some point, Twitter prompted me that like, oh, it's back within like 15 or something like that. And I was like, well, you know, I think I got to get back on and watch it. So I ended up catching pretty much, I think, the whole fourth quarter, or like almost the entire fourth quarter. First of all, I'm not surprised at all that it happened. I actually think the Cavs played pretty good defense last night for like a lot of the game. LeBron in particular, like he actually played real defense for maybe one of the first times all year, with some of the best their defense has looked for the entire year. And for once, they were actually just missing open shots. I don't know if you saw the same thing as me, Mo, but at a certain point in the game, weren't they like 5 for 25 from 3 or something like that at one point? And a lot of those, as usual with the Cavs, were open looks from good shooters. So a part of me during the game was thinking, like, it's kind of funny that the Cavs are going to lose this game kind of in the opposite way that they've lost most of their other games this year, where their offense is actually kind of the thing that's failing them. But also in the back of my mind, I was like, well, if they ever start to actually hit a shot in this game, they could really win because they're actually defending pretty well. And then they started hitting shots, and it kind of just rolled downhill from there.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. I mean, it's exactly that. They were missing a ton of open shots. The numbers somewhere were, you know, 5 and like 20, I think, or 25, like somewhere in that range. You're right. Like they just weren't making shots, and they were pretty good defensively. And, you know, the other thing
for them, like relatively, right? Like for their status, I thought that was one of the best defensive games they played all year. I don't know what their defensive rating was, but
yeah, it definitely, like, you felt like it. And the other thing too is it was like LeBron with all that kind of that talk beforehand and things like that, although he said it wasn't directed at those guys, is directed at Phil and things like that, but you kind of feel like he was trying to motivate himself to get really going, and which is funny to me because you shouldn't need much motivation to really, you know, try to play your ass off in the Garden of all places.
But at the same time, I can see it, right? Like you hear all the Jordan stories about how by the mid-90s, like the guy just could not get, and nobody could touch him, so the guy couldn't get him, so he had to invent all these crazy ways in his head to motivate himself, and maybe that's why he's such a like a gambling nut job now, because he's so hardcore about that. And with a guy like LeBron, you've been to 7 straight finals. It's November. Your team's kind of languishing a bit. There's some weird stuff going on with the season. You need to kick yourself in the ass a little bit. Get yourself something. And I think LeBron is one of those guys who LeBron has always been the type who very well understands what stuff like that is going to mean. He understood how people were going to take those comments. He understood that even if he comes out later and says it wasn't directed at Frank and whatnot, everybody's going to know that it's going to get taken that way and that the players themselves are going to take it personally. He knows all of that. He knows it would make him a bit of a heel coming into the Garden for that night. And I just think that he kind of, exactly as you said, he kind of wanted a kick in the ass for himself. And at the same time, he managed to give kind of the entire league a kick in the ass for at least like a night, right?
Yeah, and LeBron doesn't do things like just haphazardly or accidentally. You know what I mean? Like he has an intention behind everything. There's a method to his madness. So even when he says a comment, it's like we don't really know necessarily what's going on. There's something behind that. Like he's really smart in that sense of like, and very calculating is maybe the word I was trying to find. But like he kind of does that. So, you know, he knows how to tweak guys. And then it's no mistake that, like, he started trying to bully the rookie in that situation. And right then and there, like, that's an opportunity and things like that, and see if the kid was going to back down. I was impressed the kid didn't back down. You know, it was funny. He did try pushing LeBron, and LeBron just didn't move. So
that tends to be what happens when you try to push that guy.
Yeah. So that probably doesn't do much for his confidence in terms of that, but it was, like, still a good thing. And then, you know, the ironic thing is, like, LeBron getting all annoyed about Enes Kanter jawing, you know, he's like, he's always got something to say. I'm like, well, he's kind of, it's kind of like what you're doing.
Right. And I see both sides of that, right? Because I have to admit a bias here. First of all, LeBron James has long been my favorite basketball player. I won't sugarcoat it. LeBron is a big part of the reason I became an NBA writer and became interested in the NBA in the first place. I think he's the greatest athlete of all time, probably. And obviously I have a bit of a bias when it comes to Enes Kanter, being, you know, that I'm from Salt Lake City and I cover the Jazz, that Kanter, you know, was slightly unceremonious with his exit from here when he left and said a few things. And that's kind of actually become a theme with him. And LeBron's kind of right. Kanter really always does have something to say. He had something to say a bunch of times in Oklahoma City with Russ-related stuff and Durant-related stuff. Now he's got a whole bunch of stuff to say here, too. But of course, at the same time, how are you going to get mad at a guy for wanting to defend his teammates, especially his rookie teammates? In that aspect, I absolutely can't fault Kanter at all.
Yeah, and that was and that's what's kind of funny to me when LeBron gets all mad about Kanter stuff. And I get it. Kanter's probably, like, the annoying guy. Everybody's like, oh, this guy again. But at the same time, it was like, you know, LeBron's mad at him for speaking out of turn. You can make the argument LeBron was speaking out of turn in the first place, you know, with the Dennis Smith and Frank comparisons. And it's not like Frank Ntilikina has been bad. Like, he's actually been pretty good. He doesn't put up crazy numbers, but he's finding his way along. He's great defensively for a rookie, which is something you don't see very often. So, you know, I was kind of like, all right, I'm not mad at either guy. You're right. It did inject some excitement. I mean, I really wasn't that excited to watch that game until this stuff started to boil down.
No, exactly. Well, I was for Porzingis because I get excited to watch Porzingis every single time. But, like, yeah, beyond that, and I like watching LeBron, him being one of my favorite athletes. Other than that, no special excitement. That had me tuning in early on that game. And then as soon as I heard, as soon as I heard in the fourth quarter that it was even, like, a moderately close game, I was like, okay, I got to watch that. Like,
yeah. And they definitely, I mean, like, they made some plays happen. Like, LeBron really created some nice stuff and got Korver some good looks. Korver was on fire in the fourth quarter. Like, at one point, you're just like, are you guys going to guard him or just let it? And then once he gets hot, it's over. Like, it doesn't matter who's guarding him.
Oh, yeah. And he gets into this mode where you can tell when he's really feeling it because there's certain shots that he won't take during the normal flow of the game. Like, if he's guarded well enough, he knows when to pass up his shots and things like that. And then he gets into one of those modes where he's hot, and he hit two or three of those last night where it's just like, normally he probably would have passed that shot up. And he just goes up anyway. He knows it's going down. That's Korver's one of the only guys in the league who goes into that mode. I love it.
Well, let's talk about a matchup I'm pretty excited about, and that's coming up this Wednesday, is the Sixers playing the Lakers, which is basically Ben Simmons versus Lonzo Ball. It's at least the way I look at it. And we're going to have two really exciting young passing guards, although Ben Simmons is incredibly huge for a guard. And not that Ball's small, but Simmons is just, like, ridiculously tall, physical and big. Like, he's just huge. You know, it's going to be a fun matchup. What are your thoughts so far on having seen these two guys play so far, you know, 10, 12 games into the season?
Well, at the moment, I don't know that I consider those two players to be on even a similar plane. Now that, of course, future ceiling-wise, there's a lot that can happen. Particularly, you know, you look, there's a big age difference. They're 2 years apart in age, and Simmons has been in the league already for a year, although he didn't play, obviously, last year. I did a scouting report on Simmons last week over at Basketball Insiders, just to do a little mini plug here. He has already ascended, for me, to the level where there are not a full hand's worth of players that I would jump to just start watching on a whim. Like, if I saw something on Twitter that, oh, Simmons is cooking, or something like that, I can't name five players who I would watch quicker. He's a massive point of fascination for me. I think he's one of the most unique players maybe ever to enter the league. The LeBron comparisons are unavoidable. I think they're ridiculous in certain areas, but they're actually more apt than people realize in certain others, particularly in transition. And I know that sounds crazy to people because LeBron is like maybe the most fearsome transition player to ever play the game, but I think there's a lot of similarities there with Ben Simmons. I won't gush too hard. As far as Lonzo goes, I think I've been surprised by certain areas of Ben Simmons' game. Like, I expected him to be good. I've been surprised by how immediately he's already been an elite level player, basically, and particularly the way he's rebounded, the way he's defended for the most part. He takes the occasional playoff, but he's been a much better defender overall than I thought he'd be. In Lonzo's case, I think I'm pretty not too surprised, really, by anything that we've been seeing so far. I was definitely worried about how his jumper was going to transfer over to the NBA level. When you got a weird looking release like that, I'm sure you've seen guys with that before, Mo. It's a lot harder to get it off when the speed and the length and everything jumps up another notch, like it does moving from college to the NBA, right? So I felt like his jumper was probably going to struggle, but then I felt like you'd see nights like the other night, I don't remember who it was against when he put down his triple-double, where you see that this is a guy who can contribute in other areas even when his jumper isn't going down. He's going to be a very good rebounder for a guard, just like Simmons. He's obviously a preternatural passer, one of the best passers for his age, coming out into the league that we've seen in a while. I think he's still kind of trying to find some of the rhythms, and of course that's completely normal. He's a 19-year-old. I'm less surprised by him than by Simmons will be what I'll finish up with there.
Yeah, it's funny, like when I try to find who to compare Ben Simmons with, to me it's really Magic Johnson. And if you look at the numbers from their rookie years, you know, obviously Simmons has only played 13 games. But the comparisons are so close in terms of just Magic averaged 18 points a game. Simmons is averaging 17.8. You know, Magic had 7.7 rebounds a game. Simmons, 9.2. 7.3 assists for Magic to 7.5 for Simmons. You know, and it's really an amazing kind of just like these guys are just so in line with that stuff. And you're right, Simmons is better defensively than I thought he would be. I actually thought he was going to be really bad defensively, and he's been quite delightful. And like you said, of course he takes plays off, he's, you know, he's still 21, he's still going to make mistakes and things like that, but you know, he's definitely more into it than we saw at LSU and so on. So like, it's been a really nice surprise of that.
Ball. And I think the thing, if I may real quick, just to kind of jump in there as well, I think the thing with his defense that we as a collective basketball community, I know I glossed over it myself, is that I made the same assumption as you, right? Like, you watched him at LSU. He took a lot of, like, he took basically every playoff on defense at LSU. He almost never played defense at LSU. And you look at that, and he has a bit of a diva reputation already from some of the media that are there and everything like that. And the assumption, I think, is, yeah, he's going to take a ton of plays off, and he's going to be a negative as a defender because he's playing out of position and things like that. I think what we glossed over was, well, and when he gets to a point where he really cares on that end, which I think he's gotten there quicker than we would have assumed he would, the skill profile and the ceiling for this guy defensively is so high. And that's something that was in my piece that Brett Brown basically talked about when I was speaking to him about Ben Simmons, is that I don't think we as a basketball community really thought about what Simmons' actual potential ceiling is defensively if he's locked in on every play. Did you? Because you think about it, he's a 6'10" guy who's really fast, has long arms, great athleticism. We've seen, like, what, 15 dunks already this season? I think this player has enormously high. But in fact, Brett Brown said to me, I think it will be easier for him to be elite defensively than it has been for him to already become elite offensively. And that quote blew my mind.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense just because how hard it is to develop your jumper. Whereas I feel like defensively, you know, especially coming from with his body type, his length, and he's strong. Like, he's not scrawny. You know, he's not a small dude by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, I think his length, his size, and his weight, you know, he can actually be a much better defender before he develops that shot. Like, that shot's going to take 2 or 3 years to really get going. And who knows if he ever even really develops that. So, I think I kind of agree with Brett in that sense of, like, he can be a better – he can be an elite defender before he's going to be elite offensively, which says a lot considering, like, he's pretty damn good on the offensive end. Like, I was at the Clipper game last night, and I mean, he put on a show. Like, he was physical with guys. He was bumping DJ. He had finesse driving by guys, you know, and you know, just dunking. Like, he dunked on Lou Williams 2 different times. Like, you know, he had a a great reverse alley-oop dunk. Like, he's got an athleticism and a motor behind him that it's like, when he's that motivated, it's just kind of, you can see it. So I'm very impressed by him. Ball, I'm impressed by him in other areas. I mean, obviously, his shooting troubles have been talked about ad nauseum. But the stuff that does impress me is he rebounds at a high rate. You know, obviously, he's a great passer. You know, he's better defensively than I thought he would be. And another surprise in that regard, and using his length. I thought, like, his lack of foot speed and I felt like he's an average athlete, I thought would be a problem for him defensively. But he's getting his hands on some pretty nice blocks. Like, he's making some nice plays in there, and it's pretty impressive in that regard. You know, the shooting stuff, his form is terrible. Like you mentioned, like, you're like, you know, you had said, like, I've never seen a form like that. I don't think many have, or at least at the NBA level. Like, that's just a terrible looking shot. And I know Sports Science did a segment on him where they figured out it's still a fairly quick release, but I still think the whole wind up from when he gets there is just really difficult to get off. And something that I think they're gonna, you know, Magic kind of alluded to it a little bit in an interview the other day, that, like, if he struggles all year with his shooting, like, we're gonna have to change his form. And that's
God, a new adjustment. I wonder what LeVar thinks about that.
Well, at that point, I know LeVar, I know UCLA, I think, wanted him to change his form at some point, and LeVar kind of stepped in. But I think it's a different deal when it's Magic saying it to you than Steve Alford.
I would certainly hope so. And Ed, for me, it's less about the actual time that it takes on the release. I saw that same Sports Science thing that you're talking about, where his release is actually not that much slower than your average guy, if at all. It's about the low point that the ball is at. That's a problem in the NBA. The NBA is a league where, especially coming from any lower level, the margins are extremely important. Everything tightens up in the NBA. Guys are inches longer on their arms, are inches longer. They're milliseconds faster in every spot that they get to. They react more quickly to everything that you do. Every little motion, everything matters. And when your shot motion involves bringing the ball basically down to your hip, every single time you need to go up for your motion, and it's a pretty distinct motion, right, where guys can tell what you're doing when you do that. Like, it's not like Lonzo has a good shot fake where he can pretend he's bringing the ball to his hip like that and then not shoot it, right? Or if he does, I haven't seen it yet. When that's the case, that's a big advantage for smart and long NBA defenders, unfortunately. And that's why I think I kind of saw that coming. I would be absolutely fascinated for if he does try and change his form at some point.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a huge project in that regard, you know. And then that takes time, and then you have to deal with the fact that, like, everybody's going to play off him. Makes it difficult for him, like, because he's not – the difference between playing off Ben Simmons and playing off Lonzo Ball, Simmons is 6'10", and his stride and his length, and it's the same as Giannis. Like, that's an advantage to them. If you let them get ahead of steam, they can get to the rim in one or two steps, you know, or one or two less steps than it would take an average basketball player. And that allows them to create a little bit. And with their length and stuff, they're going to finish over you. They don't need to be that close. Whereas with Ball, like, if you lay off him a little bit, it's going to make it harder, you know, and it's going to be a tough challenge for him. You know, I know people are giving him he's getting a rough go, and partly because of LeVar, but he's, you know, I don't like to slam rookies. And I think he's still going to be a really good player in the league. I think he'll figure out his shot, you know, at some point. But it's like, it's just hard to watch. It's hard because they hyped him up so much. Not just LeVar, but Magic and the Lakers. This is the face of the franchise. They traded D'Angelo Russell because they needed a leader, so they went and got him. And you still just, you're just not really kind of, if he can't play, if he's not that good, if he's not the star level that they're talking about, then it's a failure. And it's tough to put that bar on a kid that's 19 years old before he plays a game.
Yeah, it sure is. And that's why, you know, I'm happy to say, Mo, that I've come to a point over the last couple of years where I hate hype just in general. Like, I just don't like it because for the most part, it's like so badly directed. And this is basically the best example ever. Lonzo Ball could be an unbelievable NBA player, and he deserves to have the on-court hype that he did as a college player for the stuff that he did on the basketball court. But all the other stuff that's come along with it, me personally, I've basically tuned it out because I don't have time for it. I like basketball, the game of basketball, right. not the other stuff. So from that perspective, it doesn't bother me when I look at that, but you're absolutely right about the expectations that get put on a kid. So for me, like I said before, while I do have slightly lower thoughts on ball than I think most draft evaluators did, and that's without, you know, I am not a professional draft evaluator. I do my work each year, but those guys do a lot more. So I want to give that caveat. That said, I'm a little lower on both his ceiling and his floor than I think most people are. I have severe concerns about his athleticism basically for his whole career. I don't know that he's really going to ever be at a point there where that's at even an average level in the NBA. But all that said, if we're looking at what he's done so far this year and viewing it as some kind of massive failure, either on his part or on the Lakers' part, to me, that's ridiculous. Like, that's just completely ridiculous. He's a rookie. He's 19. I guess he's 20 now. He's 20 years old. Like, the kid is not – this is not going to – rookies are not elite. Ben Simmons is showing us a very big exception to this rule, and it's because, first of all, he's in some ways not a rookie. He's been in the NBA for a year, and he's 21, which helps, and he's a physical freak that we've seen come out, what, once every decade to this point in the NBA or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, that's what that you hit it right there, you know, and it's always hard. To me, it's like I will judge rookies, you know, when they come out of the gate and kill it, like I will start going like, wow, that's really impressive, and I'll be impressed by that. But I won't kill a kid when he's struggling early on because this shit's hard.
Yeah, and especially when you're thrust into that kind of a role, there's almost no 19-year-old on the ever to come into the NBA with his size and all his specifics who would have been ready for that kind of a thing. And yeah, I think you touched actually earlier in one of your comments on what the big difference is between him and a guy like Simmons as far as defense is playing off you. If that shot doesn't come around, is ball shoots so far in the year, I think he's shooting about 42% near the rim, and Simmons is at like 70%. And exactly what you said is kind of the point here. It's a much easier to game plan, especially while Lonzo's jumper is this broken. It's much easier to game plan against him offensively right now than it is to game plan against Ben Simmons, because Simmons, like as I noted in my article, he's got a Blake Griffin-ness in him where he knows that if he gets himself in the air with a clear line of sight to the rim and he's anywhere within like 5 feet, he's going to finish. He's got the length to finish. So he kind of just spins and contorts his way, gets himself in the air, and then just figures it out later. You know the type of Blake play that I'm talking about where he gets himself there first, worries about the finish afterwards. Simmons already does that kind of thing, and that's something that Lonzo, unfortunately, is not really ever going to have in his game because of his size and his athleticism. So that's a huge difference right off the bat.
Yeah, and that's going to be the biggest challenge. I'm very excited for the game. I have kind of de facto turned into a Sixers fan. Just by watching these guys and Embiid, and Embiid was great last night against the Clippers, which leads to this. The Clippers are in trouble. they got some.
Yeah.
I mean, they've lost six straight after kind of starting the season pretty hot. You know, they have some major injury issues. Like, they've lost to Doncic, which I think is, I don't think people realize how big of a blow that is for them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Beverly's been out the past few games with, a knee. Gallinari's been out the past few games with it's basketball reference is great because it just says a strain in his butt. So I don't know what that is. But some sort of injury. And there's no real talk of when these guys are coming back. And this was my concern with the Clippers going into this season was you got a bunch of guys that are good. And if you're healthy, you're probably a playoff team. But their history, past history, has shown that Gallinari misses a ton of games. Beverly's good to miss 10 to 15 games. You always get a Blake injury somewhere in the middle of the year. You know, this is kind of coming to fruition. You know, this crazy injury stuff kind of rearing its ugly head to the Clippers. You know, how worried are you about the Clips?
That's a really interesting question, because there are also, I think we've also seen some signs in a few of these games that are maybe not 100% injury related, right? Like, I think Blake's game has definitely fallen off a good bit since the start of the year. Now, it's hard to say whether some of that is probably a cause of having different players on the court with him, guys who aren't able to complement him as well. Some of it might also be him or the way defenses are playing him or something like that. At the same time, you're right, and I wonder, did they just get kind of screwed and unlucky in this one patch that we're in right now where they lost Beverly Gallinari, Taya Dosich, all within, what, like 2 weeks of each other. And they had a few, you know, relatively tough games in there. Like, I think we look at Philly on Monday night as a bad loss, but I don't know if we're going to, by the end of the season, we might not view
that's
it that way.
That's not right? a bad loss to me. Philly's actually right. good. Like,
yeah, Philly's pretty good. Like, and they've played some, you know, I'm going actually to look at who they've played in this little losing streak. They've had a few good teams in there. OKC, the Pelicans have been going really well lately. The Spurs, Miami plays a great team scheme. Like, they don't really have any bad losses in that group of six. So you wonder, is this maybe just like some really shitty timing where they got hit with those injuries all at the same time, right as they went into kind of this tough stretch? But then at the same time, like I say, I also have noticed some indicators that maybe don't speak only to the injuries. So I'm kind of a mixed bag on it. And I think the biggest factor is, when are they going to get these guys back? Which, as you mentioned, we don't really know right now.
Yeah. And the other guy who's kind of struggled a bit is DeAndre Jordan, because his game was so tailor-made for pick-and-roll basketball. Not just him setting the picks. And I was having a conversation on Twitter with Justin Russo and, Anthony Irwin. I think I said his last name right. About this. And it was DJ last year got his buckets off of lobs mostly from Chris Paul coming off a pick and roll, or Chris Paul coming off a pick and roll set by Blake, the ball going to Blake, and then the defense reacting to that, and then Blake finding DJ for a lob. Now they're not running as much pick and rolls, and I don't have the numbers in front of me from what I've viewed and what I've seen so far. I'm not seeing as much pick and roll. A lot more Blake in the post, and he's creating for guys out of that. And as Justin had said, it was they're kind of going inside out more. But that hurts DJ, because that's not where DJ's game's at his best. And it actually hurts Blake, because DJ can't space the floor, so it's an easier double, you know, for them to send another big man or whatnot. So it makes things challenging for them. And that's something I find really a problem. And that's where not having Taya Dosich out there, because he's a great pick and roll player that I think would have been a guy that that would have really helped them. So, I mean, that's my big concern with them is I'm not sure, I look at him now and I'm just like, the more you free fall, like, you got to stop the bleeding, because in the West, it's not going to be easy to get back in the race.
Yeah, DJ, to speak to what you're talking about, DJ career-wise is a 72% shooter within 3 feet of the basket, shooting 61% this year. From within 3 feet of the basket. I think that's a pretty clear, identifier that the looks he's getting there are just not the same. And I do think that that's to some degree, obviously Taya Dosich being out is part of it, but I think the Clippers' hot start at the start of the year had a few of us, a lot of us kind of thinking, is it possible that their parts can be greater than some of a whole, or excuse me, you know what I'm trying to say, badly failing at it, but you know what I'm trying to say, whereas maybe in previous years it was the opposite, with kind of, especially come playoff time, like how their talents kind of melded with each other with Chris and that whole thing. But we're also now, I think, starting to see, especially as you get into the slog of a season, game after game after game, 82 games, how much easier Chris Paul made things on these guys in general. And the fact that he was that great but also could be played defensively and was an elite defensive player, which is obviously a big difference with a guy like Taya Dosich, even if he does get back this year. I think we're seeing how much the Clippers miss Chris Paul, which in the end shouldn't really shock us because he's Chris Paul and he's really good. But I think we had maybe, because of their hot start, had kind of convinced ourselves, they're going to be fine without him, and hadn't really considered all the ways that his absence hurts them.
Yeah, I think the Clippers themselves are getting a dose of that reality a little bit of, like, wow, Chris actually really meant a lot for us. And I think, there's always the talk of struggles between Chris, Blake, and DJ. I think those guys are beginning to realize what life is like without Chris, and I don't want to say there's regret, but there's definitely going to be a little bit of, like, he did really help us a lot last year. But let's go to the other team that had a huge injury this week and is a huge concern of mine. And yours, because you're in Salt Lake, but the Jazz with Rudy Gobert going out 4 to 6 weeks. I mean, man, that's going to be a tough one.
Yeah. I'll be totally honest. I was the first 10 games of the season had me slightly more pessimistic about the Jazz in general, even before Gobert's injury. But then since it, and of course you have to factor in multiple other injuries, because of course it wouldn't be a Utah Jazz season if there weren't multiple significant injuries to rotation players. They've also lost Dante Exum, presumably for the year, although I guess we don't know that for sure at this point. And they've lost Joe Johnson, who, as we're recording this podcast, we received news that Joe Johnson will be out at least another 2 weeks, which is actually a pretty big blow to the Jazz with the fact that Gobert's going to be out for that period as well. That hurts. Now, of course, Gobert's absence makes things even worse and exacerbates things. There was, I think, a very brief in my head moment where I kind of thought, when you break it down without Gobert, the Jazz still have a number of high, at least by reputation, high-quality defenders, right? They've got Thabo Sefolosha. Joe Ingles has a great reputation as a defender. Ricky Rubio. Derek Favors has generally been very good. Ekpe Udoh is one of the best defensive players, I think, in the league, even though he's a total zero offensively. Donovan Mitchell has been a very good defender since he's come into the league. Like, that's six or seven guys you can point to and say the Jazz have good individual defenders on their team. And part of my thought was maybe this acts as kind of almost a catalyst, because the Jazz's system over the last several years has very rightfully so been built around kind of drawing guys into the right positions in the paint so that Gobert can terrify them and that the defense succeeds, right? Players are actually taught in certain situations in the Jazz's system to angle guys certain ways and kind of funnel them into the paint at the right angles, of course. You can't just let guys get there willy-nilly, but that's kind of their scheme. My thought was, without Favors, because I felt like at times the Jazz maybe over-relied on that with Gobert there. They put him in bad positions, maybe got a little too lax with their perimeter defense, assuming, well, Rudy's behind me. With Gobert out, my thought was, okay, they've got all these guys who are pretty solid defenders, especially several on the perimeter. They're going to play a much more switch-heavy style, with Favors being the center, playing more small ball type of lineups, Sefolosha at the four, things like that. And maybe this is a real chance for their perimeter D to kind of reestablish themselves as a strong unit, not have to depend so much on Favors, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and then they played the Wolves on Monday night. And it just, my concern, of course, with that line of thought had been trying to kind of make changes on the fly to a scheme that most of your players have been running for the last couple of years. And unfortunately, it looks like making those kind of changes on the fly is going to be very, very difficult, because the Jazz screwed up an enormous number of just basic things last night. And when they didn't have that safety valve of Gobert kind of standing back there to help them out with it. And I know that one game shouldn't necessarily dampen my potential enthusiasm much, but seeing it and seeing how tough it was for them clearly to process the new things that they had to do without Gobert back there, I don't see any way that they're going to be able to really make that adjustment before Gobert is back. I think they're going to really struggle against good offensive teams, and I don't, unfortunately, think that the resulting spacing that they're going to find offensively, now that they're not playing Favors and Gobert together while Gobert is injured, I don't think that's going to be enough to catapult their offense to where it needs to be to make up for what they're going to lose defensively. Because the other thing we saw against Minnesota was I think David Locke, the Jazz radio announcer, said the Jazz generated 57 open looks to just 37 for Minnesota, but the teams made within like two or three of each other of the same amount. So the Jazz just don't have guys that can make shots. They just don't have enough of them. And when you combine that with the fact that their defense is going to really take a hit now with Gobert, yeah, it's looking pretty pessimistic.
I mean, that was the question going into the season, was can the Jazz score enough to compete? Because we knew they could defend. But now, again, you lose Gobert, and you're right on. Like, it's such a different mindset how you're playing when you have a shot blocker behind you versus when you don't. You know, you could take a few more chances. You can reach a little more. You might be able to tip a ball. Might be able to make something happen. But now you got to take a few less chances because you can't let the ball handler get by you and all that fun stuff. So, you know, it's really interesting because their offense has struggled so much. And then Joe Johnson, like you're saying, is going to be out the next 2 weeks. Like, here's another guy that was a good offensive threat for them that teams had to pay attention to. It's really tough. And again, same as the Clippers, it's the West is too difficult. Like, you dig yourself a big hole early in November or December, I don't know if you're going to be able to get out of it come February, come March and April.
Exactly. They, you know, the Jazz have had, I think, one of the easiest strengths of schedules in the NBA so far this year, and they're 6-8 is the best they've managed to come out with it. There's a lot of talk around here. There's a local columnist named Kurt Cragthorpe who was doing some tweeting to this effect. The Jazz's next two games are against Brooklyn and the Knicks, which gives them a chance to get to 8-8 if they could win both those games. There is a lot of pessimism around here that they'll ever get back to 500 this year if they don't win both those games. Because you look at their schedule after that, it's a gauntlet. It's the West. It's incredibly difficult. And you get yourselves a few games in a hole, and then I think for the start of December, they go into like a really tough stretch where they play like Houston, San Antonio, Oklahoma City, Golden State, Cleveland, Boston, a whole bunch of those teams in an early December stretch. If you're a few games below 500 going into that, your season could be over by the new year. And that's what the Jazz are facing right now, and they're facing potentially having to maybe pivot as far as what their franchise direction is for this season. Pivot from you're really going hard for a playoff seed to, well, should you be considering giving a lot of developmental time to guys like Donovan Mitchell and Tony Bradley even, who's mostly played in the D-League, and think about your draft pick next year. It sucks to already be saying that in November, but it's where they're at right now.
I mean, that's the problem with injuries. And, you know, I don't know if you know much about injury prevention, but I make it my purpose in life to know this, Ben. And
it's something that I'm really interested in, so I'm definitely up for talking about it.
Well, I found that gelato cures all.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm telling you, and I listen, I've been about as healthy as I could have been over the past 3 years since I found my favorite gelato place in Los Angeles called Gelateria Uli in downtown LA, and they have a second location, Ben, right by the Grove. This is obviously, you're in Salt Lake, you don't know much, but whenever you come out to LA, I will take you for
gelato. I got a brother out in LA, so I'm writing this down.
Done. You got to tell him it's right by the Grove. It's on 3rd Street and Crescent Heights. I'm hoping I get the cross streets correct, but you can just look this up on Google, people. They got great flavors, Ben. They got speculoos cookies, which is like my favorite. They got the classics, pistachio, banana, lemon.
That's what I was going to ask about, pistachio. That's my gelato flavor.
There we go. So that's what I'm saying. And it's great injury prevention. I don't think people realize how much gelato helps you from injuries. I think the Clippers need to start filling up their the team flights and their fridges with gelato. I think the next time the Jazz come in, they got to load up on this.
Has that been the Suns' secret all these years?
I can neither confirm nor deny, Ben.
Okay, well, that sounds to me like pretty promising the way you say it. You know, you can't confirm or deny. That could mean it's true.
Yeah, so I highly recommend anybody in the L.A. area, check out Uli's Gelateria. You can't go wrong. It's a great place, great flavor, great people. You'll enjoy it. Even if you get hurt afterwards, you'll at least be happy because you have gelato.
That's awesome.
So after that stunning gelato ad, Chris Paul is coming back this Thursday, also because I sent him a shipment of gelato.
Nice.
He's coming back for the Rockets this Thursday, and they're red hot, right? Like, they're winners. They've won 6 straight, 11-3 on top of the West, tied with the Warriors. Is this a good thing or a bad thing, Chris Paul? There's been a lot of talk, you know, everybody kind of going nuts because James Harden's been on a tear, kind of picking up where he left off last year. You know, what's your thoughts? Like, how is Chris going to affect the Rockets?
No, I'm going with pure like 99.9% good thing. You're right. There could be some adjustments, and it could take, you know, maybe a little bit of some figuring out with James and Chris. But I think the last couple of weeks, the last 3 weeks or so, has proven to us pretty convincingly that at least for now, the Rockets don't have to worry about not being one of the top three seeds in the West this year, even if they were to lose Chris for another period, or maybe even lose James for a period, or, you know, whatever kind of weird stuff might happen. I think we're pretty confident right now. This is one of the few elite teams in the West besides the Golden State Warriors, right? And with that in mind, I think the whole goal for this Rockets team needs to become, we need to put ourselves in the best possible position in every way to be able to compete with said Warriors come playoff time. And so as long as they're not worried about, you know, having to jostle for seeding, which I think the fact that both Oklahoma City and San Antonio have had their struggles at times, and San Antonio is still we're still wondering when Kawhi is going to get back. I hope that happens before the new year, by the way. With all that, you know, currently being in place, I don't think the Rockets are too worried about, like, they need to win every single game, and they've got, you know, they have to win 65 games just to make sure that they've got a, you know, they've got the 2 seed even and get the, you know, a couple of home playoff series to start off. I think they can be relatively confident in that. I think Daryl Morey, it doesn't really have too many concerns there. And with that said, my absolute number one priority is let's get these guys as much time as possible together, because it is going to take some time to adjust and get Chris kind of optimized within this system. Let's spend the next 70, whatever, 60, whatever games we got left doing that at every single game as much as we can, because we need to be primed and 110% ready to go if we do end up facing the Warriors in the playoffs to even have a chance.
Yeah, and the thing for me is, first off, a lot of people talked about, like, do they even need Chris? I'm like, yes, because everybody's forgetting how tired James Harden was at the end of the playoffs last year. You know, and it's, you know, they're like, well, if he's doing all of this, I'm like, no, the whole point is he needs to, they got Chris so he doesn't have to do this on a nightly basis. So that's something that people need to remember, and I think that's where you're going to see the value. And you're right, they have to get as many reps together as possible, or, you know, and how to get the team going. The one thing they can't lose, that they can't really lose sight of, is how well Eric Gordon's been playing. You know,
oh, man.
I mean, he's averaging nearly 23 points a night. He's shooting 35% from three. He's been red hot. He's been huge for them. He's playing great defensively. Like, that's a guy you got to make sure he's still getting touches and keep making sure he's fed, because you want to keep that going, you know. And Chris might have to be the one to sacrifice a little bit in that regard. James is going to have to sacrifice a bit. But you need to keep those guys going. And I think that's kind of the key for me. I think getting Chris back is obviously going to be a good thing. They might slip a little in the beginning just because, again, it's that adjustment period and trying to figure things out. But I'd rather they struggle with that in November and December instead of April or May,
right,
when they're competing in the playoffs. They need to figure that stuff out sooner than later and get that going. So I think that's kind of the key thing. But I really just want to see that they kind of keep Eric Gordon going at the same time. You know, I don't want to see his number of shots really drop dramatically. I think that's kind of an important thing, right?
You look at their schedule that's kind of coming up. It's a bit of a mixed bag. So he'll be back Thursday when they play the Suns. So that should be a W. They got Memphis on. So then it's Memphis, Denver. But then they've got Knicks, Nets, Pacers, Lakers, Jazz all in a row. And the Jazz are still going to be totally killed by injuries by that point. That's five in a row that they should probably win all those games, like, regardless of whether they have an adjustment period. So you look at that, I don't think they're going to be hurt too much. If they lose one extra game because they reincorporate Chris, whatever. In the long run, I don't think that's a particularly big deal at all. Your point about rest is definitely a significant one, as is your point about keeping guys who are going well right now confident. The other guy who I would mention with that would be Clint Capela. And I actually think that getting Chris back could help with that, because Chris, as we know, is one of the best lob throwers in the league and a fantastic point guard defender, who I think that's the type of guy that helps out a player like Clint Capela.
Yeah, and I mean, we saw what he did for DJ the past few years. Like, Capella's just going to be getting lobs galore.
Yep.
Another thing I wanted to point out about the schedule that you touched on, 12 of their next 17 games are at home.
Oh, wow, yeah.
That's huge. That's huge for them. And it gets a little tough, but it's not even that tough, actually, now that I look at it. But it's like being at home 12 games out of those 17, that's a good run. Obviously, you're going to pay for it later by a couple long road trip stretches. But this is good. It builds that momentum. Keep it going and try to keep that rhythm going. So I'm excited for
them. They play seven straight at home from December 11th to December 22nd. They play seven straight home games without traveling at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice little run, which means somewhere down the road, they're going to have – I mean, they're – it actually doesn't look like they have a schedule, a road trip longer than four games, which is a little nice treat for them. But that's kind of a good thing for them, kind of keeping that going and get that rhythm. So I'm with you there on Chris. I want to talk about one last team, and then I'll let you go, because I don't want to hold you hostage much longer. The Thunder have struggled. You brought it up earlier. But this weekend they had a team meeting. Then you know, Paul George dropped like 40 on the Clippers. Then he dropped 37 for Russell Westbrook's birthday present. You know, they're kind of, looks like they might be snapping out of it. What's your thoughts when you've seen of the Thunder so far? What are your thoughts?
Am I allowed to say that outside of a couple like curious details, like the Westbrook free throw thing, which is really weird? And like a couple other sort of minor margin details, I'm not that surprised by what we've seen from the Thunder so far. Am I allowed to say that? Is that like legal?
Wait, somebody call the cops.
Yeah, because I think it was clear to me from the beginning that, and I guess this hasn't materialized because Chris Paul got hurt in Houston, but of those two teams that added, you know, Western teams that added star level talent, I thought it was clearly the Thunder that were going to have the tougher adjustment period once they made the Carmelo Anthony move. I'm kind of on the same page as Zach Lowe with this, so I know he's talked about this on his pod a bit. I was super in on the fit with just Paul George, and then you heard that Anthony was coming too, and it was like, actually, maybe I'm not as convinced now by that fit. And while I do think that long-term, and by long-term I mean in the regular season, they're absolutely going to figure it out, and they're going to start rolling over bad teams pretty soon once those three stars kind of in a Miami Heat 2010 style kind of figure out how to divide things up, how to do things during the regular season. I'm not that surprised to see the three of them struggle overall, and I'm not going to be that surprised to potentially see them struggle against the elite in the playoffs. And I'm not sure that this is a team that has quite the shot to be a challenger in the West that others have noted, because I just really don't love the fit there, particularly with Carmelo. He's not the type of player who fits with Russ and Paul to me. I don't know if you agree with that.
I do. I think the hardest thing is how late that trade was made. I mean, that trade was made right before training camp started. And I think that kind of changes everything. Look, the Paul George trade happened late June, just before the draft. The whole thing was like, that whole summer, Russ and Paul George are talking, figuring out how to work. Billy Donovan's working on schemes and trying to figure out how he's going to make this work. And then you add Melo at the last second, and it's kind of like, oh, now we have to reconfigure everything. I did a thread of tweets on Twitter. I don't know the proper phrasing for that. Sorry, people. But, you know, I kind of just talking about it. And I think, you know, what the Thunder are doing now is playing Melo, you know, giving him a lot of minutes with the second unit. And what we've noticed also is a less aggressive Russell Westbrook. But I think it needs to be the opposite. I think Westbrook needs to get more time with the second unit and let him be that ultra-aggressive Westbrook during that time with those guys. And Melo, it's got to be less is more with him. That's kind of my new philosophy on it. Like, he's got to be the third option. He's got to play it kind of like how Paul Pierce played it in Washington.
Yeah, and I've seen this bait. I apologize. I'm ripping somebody off from Twitter and asking this question. But what do you think are the chances that at any point this year Carmelo Anthony will actually legitimately think in his own head, I'm the third best player on this team?
Oh, I don't think.
Because I think they're close to none. Like, I think there's no chance he thinks that.
I think there's no way that happens. The only, unless he gets injured and misses like 10 games and watches the team go 8-2, where they're able to really kind of put it together. And then he's got to, like, then I got to kind of come in and figure this out. And how do I, you know, how can I help him? Like, clearly, like, I don't want to come in and screw this up.
Right. I actually, kind of down that same theme line, I actually haven't minded the theme of playing him as the primary bench star, because that kind of helps feed that ego, right? That, but which is a very big part of coaching in the NBA, of course, is the whole, okay, Carmelo, you get 10 minutes a night where you're running things. Like, you know, this is just you. And then the rest of it, you have do your best to compromise and kind of fit in with our guys and things like that. I'm my jury is still out, I suppose, on whether or not I would make a change with that. I definitely see your point as far as kind of a similar thing with letting Russ have that role coming off the bench. I think the fact that the way they're using George is probably the best so far, because he's the most malleable of the three, and I think he's shown that so far. He's had some on and off nights with his shot, but overall the shot has been pretty fantastic. I think he's shooting like 42% from three. I just don't know that there's enough tinkering that they can, because of course when it comes down to it, when we get into the big games in April, May, June, the minutes where, you know, two of those stars are off the floor are not going to be as large of a concern, because they're not going to happen as often, right? And I have legitimate concerns, especially against the teams that they have aspirations of beating, the Houstons and Golden States of the world, about whether those players are going to be able to complement one another even close to well enough to compete with those kinds of teams. I'm dubious for now.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And again, that's kind of like where if Melo can just check his ego and say, I don't need to average 17 shots a game. I'm good with 12. You know, like, that's such a huge difference for that team. You know, and things will be a bit different, and I think we would see a more aggressive Russ, a more assimilated Paul George, because I think it can work with the three of those guys. I think it's just going to take time. I disagree a little bit, because I think they'll get it going. My thought about them from the beginning of the season was they're going to struggle early on. Like, I'm not surprised with their struggles now. I think they will get it going towards the playoffs, and then they're going to be the team nobody wants to play in the playoffs because they're going to be a tough out. Because they do have three potential stars, you know, two and a half. I'm going to call Melo a half. You know, he's
interesting.
He's dwindling. Like, it's going down. Like, let's just be honest about what he is.
Right.
But again, to me, if he can just learn to embrace that Paul Pierce Washington Wizards role, like, then they can really do some big things. And I think that's their chance. But if the way it's looking now, like, if they're really just going to keep doing this all season, your turn, my turn, his turn, they're that's it. They're done. Like, they're that's not going to work. And part of that to me is I'm not sure Billy Donovan was the right coach for this three. Like, that's a tough coaching job for anybody. But I just don't think he's the guy for that.
Yeah, that could be something of a David Blatt situation, where a guy is brought in for a different role at the time, and then things change, and you wonder whether he's right for the current role. I don't think we're actually that far apart on what we think is going to happen with them the rest of this year. Like, I think they're, from a regular season standpoint, they're going to get it together sometime pretty soon. They may already be in the process of that happening. And when they're playing your average, you know, 20 of the teams in the league, they're going to roll over a lot of teams because they're good. The star power, just the simple talent that they've got there is really going to roll. And you may even be right. They may even enter the playoffs with a bit of that reputation of a, because maybe they're going to have a lower seed than what their quality would indicate. Maybe they're going to finish like fifth or something, or sixth even. But once they actually get there, and especially if they get to facing even a Spurs or the Rockets or the Warriors especially, I think we're going to potentially run into diminishing returns as far as those stars go.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to be something to keep an eye on. Ben, plug your stuff, man. Tell the people where to find you, dude.
All right, you can find me on Twitter at Ben_Dowsett. That's Dowsett. You can find all my work at Basketball Insiders, where I am a deputy editor and senior writer. We have a nice little author page where you can just open up and view my archive if you want. Like I mentioned earlier in the pod, I recently did a scouting report on Ben Simmons. That's my most recent article. Beyond that, I don't necessarily want to plug any one thing, just that I made a big effort this offseason to kind of change my writing style. I've kind of zoomed out a bit, gone a bit more big picture, tried to do more featurey type things, and I did one big piece on NBA League Pass and how that's changed. I did a big piece on compiling a list of all the major statistics databases on the web, and to toot my own horn a little bit, I've been proud of the work that I've done. So please go check it out. Let me know what you think. I would love to hear constructive criticism as well, because I'm trying to better myself in that regard.
You should be proud of what you've done. You're doing great stuff, man. I definitely appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate that.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
And that's it for this week. Be sure to rate us, like us, leave reviews on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and wherever else you listen to your podcasts. Be sure to also check us out at thejumpball.net. Have yourselves a great week.